am I? I'm a psychiatrist, been working in the field for over 30 years. I've been doing research pretty much all the time, mostly into the effects of drugs on the brain. I've had 4 kids, and so I've been through teenage drug taking and drinking and pregnancies and things. And I'm an ex-government drug supplier, which of course is the real reason I'm here. But the rest are pretty mundane. And this sums it up. It's a real honour to be caricatured by the Guardian. So the white coat is a very rare thing. I only wear it when I'm doing films these days, because you can't be a scientist unless you're a white coat. This is a cannabis book. But the real core of the story is here. This is the scales of justice, and there's cigarettes and tobacco, and there's other drugs. And the debate that I was having with the government was around the relative harms of these, particularly in terms of national health priorities. So that's what the Guardian think I am. This is what other people have, some slightly polarised opinion in the UK. The Sun is not quite bottom of the heap, because it's still got words, but it's Poison. The Mail, which is sort of middle brow, middle England, conservative individuals. This lady doesn't like me very much. And this man is quite an entertaining sort of fascist commentator. No greater accolade, I can tell you. So why was I sacked? It's not entirely clear. The government hadn't actually issued any sensible statement about it, but it was claimed I was giving mixed messages about drugs, which was meant as telling people that alcohol was dangerous. They'd lost confidence in me, which means that they'd lost confidence in my ability not to say awkward things. And because I gave a public lecture in my professional academic capacity, which was reflecting on aspects of the drug laws and the possibility for injustice if we don't get them right. And that was published the morning I was sacked. It caused quite a lot of media interest, and I gave some interviews, and the government didn't like it, so they decided to get rid of me, which was actually a pretty dumb thing to do, because if they hadn't, it would have gone away, and I'd still be kind of bumbling around in civil service, but now I'm here talking to the rest of the world. So what did I actually say? Well, I said the drug laws were not based on science and therefore potentially unjust, and laws are supposed to be just. And I said that the UK's government's focus, which it had been in recent years on cannabis and ecstasy, was actually distracting attention from the real killer, which is alcohol. And I also said that if alcohol had been discovered today, it would be illegal, certainly in most countries, and they didn't like it. And the drinks industry were very uncomfortable with that. And a lot of it hinges on what is a drug and who says. And there's a lot of different opinions. A lot of people don't think that alcohol or tobacco are drugs, and they think they're not drugs because they wouldn't be legal if they were drugs, would they? You know, it's kind of self-evident. You know, a lot of people want us to believe that as well. I don't have to tell you they're wrong. So what is a drug? Well, you know what a drug is. It's a chemical which, when you take it, it produces some physiological change in the body. In the context of what we're talking about today, it's something that you take which gets into the brain and has some kind of pleasurable or desirable effects. And that's what we're talking about. And people use drugs for different reasons. You can kind of eventually see a common pathway, which is to increase hedonic tone, to make yourself feel better. But some people use drugs to reduce suffering. And some people use drugs to gain pleasure. And it's important to distinguish these. And one of the problems with current drug laws is that they don't. And so people that need drugs to reduce suffering, like multiple sclerosis sufferers who get prison sentences in the UK for growing their own cannabis, suffer even more because of the criminalisation of their behaviour. What we do know is that there are important differences between drugs in terms of the route of administration, the brain mechanisms which drugs work on, and these can have quite important consequences in the long-term harms that drugs produce. And just a few examples of psychiatric reasons for using drugs. So if you take alcohol, about a quarter of all young male alcoholics have a disorder called social anxiety disorder, which is extreme difficulties in making social interactions, particularly with members of the opposite sex. And it's actually the commonest treatable cause of alcoholism. So young male alcoholics, a quarter of them will have social anxiety. Treat that, you can help them stop drinking. A lot of older drinkers drink to reduce stress, to assist relaxation, and to help them sleep. Other cannabis users do for the same reasons. And there is no obvious reason to prefer alcohol to cannabis. Neither are particularly good for sleep or stress, but many people use them for those. And many people with schizophrenia smoke cannabis. We don't know why they get benefits from it. It often aggravates their psychosis, but obviously seems to help in other ways. And there's also this phenomenon that many people with ADHD use stimulants for their paradoxical calming effect, which is almost diagnostic of the disorder. Now, in the UK, drugs are controlled in this fashion. It's not so dissimilar in New Zealand. Drugs are controlled under the Medicines Act. They're medicines. They're controlled under legal controls if they're used for recreational purposes. We have drugs like coffee and cat. Cat is currently legal in the UK, but not legal here. Cat is a kind of chewable coffee that people from East Africa like to use. And these are unregulated. They just get sales tax. And then we have these drugs here, solvents, which kill young people who inhale them, and so we try not to sell them to young people. Alcohol and tobacco, which kill young and old people. And we sell it to people over a certain age, and we sell it in a regulated fashion with an increased taxation to try to curb use. So that's the current way in which drugs are controlled. Of course, many legal drugs, many medicines are also illegal if they're used for non-medical purposes, so they fall under both acts. But the interesting question, which was raised by a committee that I chaired about 5 years ago, the Foresight Committee, was why don't we regulate all drugs under the same act? Because there's no intrinsic reason why you shouldn't do that. It might actually make life a lot simpler, might help in terms of helping reducing damage, improving educational messages, etc. So that was a sort of starting point for this dialogue about the harms of drugs and the regulation of them. In the UK, we have a three-class system, just like you modelled yours on ours. You did it rather better than us, because you've actually got more of the drugs in the right classes. The white letters are drugs classification in New Zealand, where they differ from the UK. So you have ecstasy, MDMA in class B, we have it in class A, you're right. You have cannabis in class C, we have it in B, you're right. You have GHB in class B, I think you're right. But anyway, the point is that there are three classes: very high risk, moderate risk. We don't have lower risk for reasons I don't understand, but that's historic. And we have drugs which are green here; those are drugs that are medicines. We have drugs which are red, which have never been medicines, and we have drugs in the middle which may have been, may yet be medicines. So that's, but these currently are not medical. This is medical. Now, the Misuse of Drugs Act was designed to classify drugs so penalties could be applied appropriately for the misuse of these drugs. It was designed to be flexible so that drugs could come into the Act, go out of the Act, move up a class, go down a class, depending on evidence of harms. But in fact, what you see is over the years, things come in and move up, but they never go down. It's like a one-way gate. And the only drug that ever moved down a class in the UK in the 40 years we've had the Misuse of Drugs Act was cannabis, which went down from, some of it was class A, some was class B, and it went, in 2002 it went to class C. And that created the most amazing hysteria amongst the press and many politicians, and there was a running war for 5 years until eventually government overruled the ACMB and moved cannabis back to class B. And part of the reason I was sacked was reflecting on that process of movement, and I'll share with you some of the dialogue that it has. We have quite harsh penalties in Britain for using drugs, for possessing drugs, 2 years for class C, 5 years for class B, up to 7 years for class A drugs, just for possessing them, not for selling, but for possessing and supplying. We have very, very high penalties. There's an interesting phenomenon, which I don't know if it's true here, but if you it's not illegal to have taken a drug, so if you actually are intoxicated and not doing any harm, you can't be prosecuted unless you're in prison, which is an interesting issue in human rights in itself. But having taken a drug is not illegal in the UK, but you can get civil or employment penalties if they test you. And this actually in itself, I think it's very good that we don't penalise people for having taken drugs, although some people would like to move in that direction. But it has an impact on detectability. And one of the things, the problems we have with drugs like cannabis is that if you're walking down the street and a policeman's coming towards you and you think he's going to search you, if you've got an ecstasy tablet in your pocket or a BZP pill, you can pop it and then there's no way they can arrest you. It's very hard to swallow a whole spliff. And so there's an inherent bias against drugs like cannabis, which are easier to detect and harder to get rid of. And I just want to flag at this point, I will perhaps talk about it more in discussion, but some countries, but particularly Portugal, have abolished criminal penalties for personal drug use. And that's been an enormously effective way of minimising or reducing drug harms and crime and improving health outcomes. It's been one of the most remarkable social experiments in relation to health that there's been, and it's something we should seriously consider in all countries. Now, this is the Home Secretary. This is Alan Johnson. This is the man that sacked me. And for those of you who you don't use this stuff here, do you? So that's cannabis. And I wanted to say a few things about cannabis because our government was determined. Alaska, the cannabis should be class B, because they wanted the ability to put people in prison for up to 5 years for possessing cannabis, because they thought this would be a good thing to reduce the harm of cannabis. And so now you can be arrested for possessing cannabis, the police can take you to a cell for 24 hours, and while you're there, they go and search your house. There's a good chance they'll find something you don't want them to find when they do that. And this is an amazing and powerful way of the police controlling individuals that they don't like or are suspicious of. And it's arbitrarily enacted, and it's all done with the banner of improving health. Because why are drugs illegal? Well, the real reason any law exists is to reduce dangers to society, to make society a safer or better place. And you could argue that reducing dangers of drugs to society is a reason for making them illegal. What we've done in the UK is we've tried to reduce harm to the users by criminalising them, and it goes like this. We'll criminalise you and we'll even imprison you to protect you from the possible harms of drug use. And that's explicit government policy, that argue that criminalisation and the justification is these drugs might be harmful. And that's, I don't know about you, but I have real issues about that. So if you look at cannabis, we know about half young people try cannabis, very few experience health harms, there's very little health harm to society. The current government policy criminalises a lot of people, I'll show you those data in a minute. Most of them won't be harmed by the drug, most of them won't do any harm to others. It won't impact on health. And it actually also denies access of cannabis to people who need it. We've got spastic illnesses, multiple sclerosis, etc., because they get criminalised as well. I have to ask the question, is it just? Is this a just and appropriate way of dealing with the issue of possible harms of cannabis? And of course the answer is it's not. But this is what we've done in the UK. From 2004 to 2008, we have doubled the number of people who get arrested for cannabis possession to 158,000. And that is truly a huge waste of police time, public money, and it creates a vast number of individuals who are criminalised for doing something that, as I said, is unlikely to do them any harm or do any harm to society. And we also see this very interesting social phenomenon, utterly predictable, as a massive overrepresentation of ethnic minorities, even though the users end up cannabis as white, English, Anglo-Saxons. So not only is it unjust, it's differentially unjust to minority groups. There are other reasons drugs are made illegal. Well, they're not talked about much, but I think this is one of the most important ones. This is where the debate should be, and as you'll see, we don't get to debate the moral principles of drug control because we politicians always obfuscate it by raising the health funds. There's also public opinion. Politicians will tell you we can't do things because the public wouldn't like it. And when you say to them, sorry, I thought your job was to lead public opinion, they say, yeah, well, not really, not drugs now. And then you say to them, well, here's some data of your own surveys which tell you not to worry because the public aren't as concerned as you are. Look, the survey that was done by this government 2 years ago asking people about the penalties for cannabis, 2/3 of them said, don't make it Class B. Keep it at 2 years or less for possession for personal use. So don't worry, the public actually wanted to be the law to at least be sensible about cannabis. In fact, last year, 42% of the UK population thought cannabis should be legal. So the issue of public concern is a complete red herring, and it's just it's a kind of collusion between politicians and some of the media. There are the justifications for illegality. I've talked about those. There's this one, international obligations. This is a complete smokescreen. Countries do not have to criminalise drug users under international obligations. The UN conventions do not require that. All they require is that you don't allow people to sell them openly. You can have civil sanctions. And the Netherlands with the coffee shops and cannabis, and Portugal removing all criminal penalties for drug use, have shown that that's compliant with UN conventions. There's also party politics. The reason we had an independent committee called the ACMD, from which I was sacked, was to stop politicians gaining cheap votes by being tougher on drugs or more outrageous in terms of attacking drug users than the other party. And we were supposed to have an independent assessment of drug harms to take it out of those party politics, but that happened until our last Labour government, and they couldn't resist the opportunities of trying to get into this game. And of course, then there's money. And we know that particularly the drinks industry has a phenomenal influence. We did a survey in 1995 of British politicians. We asked them a number of questions. The most interesting ones were, is alcohol a drug? And about 70% said no. And we said, is alcohol dependence, is that a physical illness or is it a moral weakness? And about 70% of them said it was a moral weakness. And then we asked them, did they have any interest in the drinks industry? And we checked whether they did or not. It was easy in those days because it was more obvious what the drinks industry was. And we found that 54% of them took money from the drinks industry. That's probably not changed a lot, but it's much harder to find out what the drinks industry is anymore because they put their money into politics behind several layers of lobby groups. One of the other interesting questions is raised by the common statement that politicians make. They say, well, look, we're not sure about drugs. We're not sure about the harms of drugs. So why don't we just ban them? Because the banning itself cannot do any harm. And of course, there are many examples of where precaution can have very perverse effects. And here's just one very graphic one. So this is a 16-year-old woman who comes from this island, Shetland, off the north coast of Scotland, somewhere between Scotland and Iceland. Not easy to get drugs there. People drink an awful lot, and teenagers don't want to be drunk like their parents, so they want to do something different. And as her friend said, the problem is that cannabis is so hard to get hold of. A lot of my friends have just gone straight onto smack, which is heroin. Because if you're a drug dealer, you're not going to run the risk of importing cannabis to the Shetland Islands, because it's smelly, the dogs can detect it, it's bulky, and there's not much profit. You go for the big, you go for the high margin. You get heroin into the island, and you get a lot of people hooked on heroin, and some will die as a consequence. And that is an example of this obsessive concern we have about stopping people smoking cannabis. That we're actually deviating people into taking much more harmful drugs and dying as a consequence. And one of the things I did over the 10 years I worked in the government was try to set up a process of properly assessing the harms of drugs, using some fundamental sort of first principles, and trying to develop a scale and a transparent process for assessing harms. And this eventually got published in the Lancet a couple of years ago. We used a sort of top-down scale, sort of an expert group of us thought that what are the harms of drugs? How can we parcel out them? And we came up with these nine harms: physical harms, acute harm to the person, you're going to die when you take it, you can cause chronic damage like alcohol causing cirrhosis, can you use it intravenously because of course intravenous use heavily weights the harms of drugs, does it cause intense pleasure, does it cause psychological dependence, does it cause physical dependence, because these things tend to lead to ongoing use, does it cause social harms of intoxication, fights from drunkenness, etc., does it cause other social harms like criminal gangs destroying neighbourhoods, and what are the healthcare costs? And we rated a whole range of drugs on those nine parameters on a 3-point scale, 0, 1, 2, and 3, 3 being the maximum. And individuals did it, and then they presented their scores to others, and we debated them. And eventually we came up with an overall score. I just want to talk you through some of the harms we considered. These are two young people who died. This guy was a golf student at Exeter University, and he died after a drinking game, after a golf match. And drinking games are very popular in British universities. One of the things we're trying to do is get them banned, because it seems a bit daft that taxpayers subsidise universities to subsidise drinking of students who go and die as a consequence of alcohol poisoning. This is Leah Betts. Leah Betts is a very famous girl in Britain. She died on her 18th birthday. She died of water poisoning. She died of water poisoning because she took 2 ecstasy tablets, and her mother told her that if she took ecstasy she must drink lots of water, but she wasn't dancing, she was just preparing for her 18th birthday party, and she went into acute water poisoning and died. And then this picture appeared on billboards all over Britain saying, "Sort it, don't take ecstasy." And although we can't prove it, we think the billboards were funded by the drinks industry, because at that time they were very worried that people would move from alcohol to drugs, and they were very concerned that their profits would start being showing attrition as a result of that. Here's another example: a young man, 18-year-old, and you must have hundreds of these in this country. Teenager, he died after drinking a whole slew of alcohol on his 18th birthday. Went home, sleep it off, and was dead in the morning when his dad was 21. In the UK, about one young person a day died of alcohol poisoning, and about one or two die of accidents or fights when they're drunk. And one of the big differences between cannabis and alcohol is you can't overdose on cannabis. You don't get to fights on cannabis. So cannabis is intrinsically more safe than alcohol. And the other factor is about date rape. Most date rapes are associated with being drunk. We did a survey with proper police assessment of date rapes, we found that about half were just drunk, and about half were drunk plus other drugs, but there was no consistent use of other drugs, no one particular drug. We can also estimate dependence and addiction, and we can do that quite easily. We can use this phenomenon called capture rates. What proportion of people who ever use a drug will become addicted to it? And for opioids, cocaine, methamphetamine, which you call P over here, and nicotine, it's between about 30% and 40%. Of every user's become dependent, have withdrawal reactions. Barbiturates, alcohol is about 15% to 20%. Cannabis, ketamine is about 5% to 10%. Ecstasy, cat, is about 2% to 4%. So you can scale drugs according to their dependence liability. And dependence has a huge impact on the chronicity of use, and that's what contributes to this kind of data. So what you have here is the UK, estimates of the UK data. The size of the circle reflects the number of users, and the red sectors reflect the number of people who actually die eventually as a consequence of using the drug. So about half of all smokers die of an illness which is attributable to smoking, about 20% of all drinkers, about 15% of all heroin users. We don't know, but it's probably 2 or 3% of cannabis users, and about a tiny fraction of ecstasy users. So the killers in the UK are still, as they have been for many years, are quite high. And they're also very costly. This is European data, looking at life years of disability caused by different illnesses. Major depression is by far the largest, but alcohol is about the same as dementia, and drug addiction is about half of alcohol. So you add them together, you get the second largest cause of disability in Europe. And this is just to show the wave of toxicity that alcohol is causing in the UK. In 10 years, we've seen hospital admissions for alcohol-related illness double. And last year, there were a million hospital episodes, probably of which a quarter of a million were admissions and three-quarters were just people coming to casualty. Ecstasy is about 2,000, cannabis about 700. So there's a disproportionate health burden from alcohol. And I want to use the next four slides to just compare and contrast cannabis and alcohol, because in a way that's the core of the debate at present. Cannabis illegal, targeted by the police, purportedly to reduce the possible health damage from using cannabis. We've seen, since the Misuse of Drugs Act in the UK was brought in 1971, we've seen a 20-fold increase in people using cannabis. There were 500,000 ever users in 71, there's over 9 million, over 10 million now. So 20 times increase in the use of cannabis, the number of using cannabis. And everyone's terrified that cannabis causes schizophrenia. In the UK, there's actually, if anything, a declining annual incidence of schizophrenia, a declining incidence of psychosis. Nowhere in the world has cannabis use been associated with an increase in schizophrenia. Now, let's look at alcohol. At the same time, from 1971 to nearly the present day, we've seen about a doubling in the intake of alcohol on average in the British population. We've seen in the last 10 years a doubling in hospital admissions for alcohol-related disorders. And that suggests to me there's a kind of lag of about 20, 25 years before the significance of the alcohol damage actually turns into, or the alcohol use turns into health damage. So not quite as long as tobacco, but we're getting it now. We're riding on the crest of this wave.